Hey, what's up, guys? On this episode of Muscle Minds, Dr. Scott has prepared a talk for us. Topics are going to be high volume versus low volume training and high carb versus low carb dieting. Scott's brought some studies. He's got some charts and graphs. He'll be breaking everything down and helping us to understand it. And in the end, hopefully you'll better understand what works better for you. It's all happening right here on Muscle Minds. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott Stevenson. I'm Scott McNally. This program is brought to you by TrueNutrition.com. They're a high-quality supplement company that has been around since I've been into bodybuilding. And you can use our code ADVICES for some additional savings on products like this. Scott, I'm doing a test. I was using the MPA Muscle Intrusion. I have some of their, Perry MD, the Mountain Dog intro workout product. But now I just bought some straight, highly branched cyclic dextrin. And uh-huh. I got the lemon cake flavor. Mix this with...
Is it good?
Yes.
It sounds delicious.
Mix that with the EAA. I was hesitant because I know that highly branched cyclic dextrin can be kind of rough sometimes with the wrong flavoring, but it's the bomb, dude. Like it is so good. So I'm excited. I want to do a price breakdown. I want to see because I add in also 3 grams of citrulline malate to that. I want to do a price breakdown and see what I'm paying per scoop compared to buying, say, a competitor's product. But I have a feeling I'm getting a decent deal on it. I know that it's all high quality stuff too. So. I like that, you know. Anyway, though, man,
50%, there's got to be a 50% markup. I mean, there's just so many ways that your nutrition is cheaper. They don't have labels. You're not paying for the labeling. You're not paying for all the mixing. You're not paying for the marketing. You're getting it pretty much raw from source. So I bet you're saving a substantial amount.
Yeah. I'd imagine. I'm going to figure it out and I'll let you guys know. Today, we have a plan Dr. Scott's got lined up for us. I'm really excited about this. I've got a few figures floating around here on my computer that he'll have me pull up as we go. Topic that we are looking at is what's better for you, right? Based off of your biology being a high or low frequency training plan, as well as a high or lower carb diet. Am I saying that correctly in a real layman's sense?
I mean, those are just two biggies. Like I come across this stuff all the time, but these are some pretty cool data.
Okay.
Those are the biggest questions. Like, so how should I train? High volume or high frequency or where should it go? Like that's a big global question and people want a black and white answer, which there obviously is not, as is the case almost every single time, except for things like, should I eat arsenic before I train or that kind of thing? Probably not. And then the low carb approach. And this has been a big one because there's so much data out there, so many studies that have been done, and mostly with obese women or diabetics. And the bottom line, of course, is first and foremost, and this is I have a nutritional hierarchy of importance, a little pyramid that's in my book showing that caloric intake is numero uno for fat loss or trying to gain one or the other. But then the next question is, so I have go low carb or go high carb? And pretty much the studies show, if you just kind of look at the whole of the research literature, that it's kind of a wash. It doesn't matter. Sometimes you get like a little bit of a better increase in HDL with low carb and a little bit better of a reduction in LDL with higher carb hypocaloric diets. So you got to have a caloric deficit. But sometimes you'll see there's sometimes a little bit of an advantage for lower carb. But when all things are equal and people are adhering equally and you got people sort of lodged into their treatment arm, meaning that they're having to eat the diet that you've assigned to them, you basically see the same thing. It comes down to caloric deficit. Of course, in the real life, that's, can be very, very different. You tell someone, don't eat carbs, and they're like, okay, that's easy. I just avoid carbs.
Right.
And it's very, I can just kind of count fat and protein. It's good. And it helps with appetite, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what is interesting about these data that we'll show, we'll talk about the training thing first, is that there's maybe something somewhat predictive about whether one person would be better off choosing one type of diet or another.
Okay.
So I'll warm people up to that, but we'll go back to the training thing. So can you throw those figures up? The first one has, like, let's see, it says Barcelos 2018 on the top, I think.
Let me see here. Let me see what order they're in here. I can figure this out. Barcelos 2018.
It's got little circular dots, three groupings.
Little circular dots, three groupings. Okay, yeah. I think I see that one. Is this the one that says? Oh yeah, it says Barcelos at the bottom. Okay, I think I got that one here. Give me just a second. Yep, here it is. Got it. So that's on the screen right now.
Yeah. So what this shows was an initial study. This was just published 2018. So they were doing this, you know, just a few years ago. And they used a really, really cool design. So people talk about using like twin studies.
Okay.
You know, this the penultimate question. So let's imagine we got two twins and one twin, you know, just pushes the calories and the weight as hard as he can. He gets just big and fat and just becomes the biggest, strongest beast possible for 3 years. And then he spends a year dieting down, holding on all that muscle. It's a 4-year plan. And his identical twin with the same genetics, you know, goes inches his way up and tries to stay lean and wants to look good for the summer and maybe competes here and there, or does photo shoots. Who's going to end up at the end of 4 years having made the most progress in terms of absolute muscle gain?
Yeah.
Like that's like, who knows, you know, and probably some variability there. Depends on which pair of twins you chose.
Yeah.
I would imagine. And how those particular things are kind of how conservative the one twin is with keeping his body fat low and what have you. Well, this is basically the same experimental design, but it's even better because twins can be subject to like epigenetic changes, and there can be some genetic differences that kind of creep in over the course of a lifetime. But in this case, you've got even more control over the genetics because they had people, the same individuals, train one leg one way, high frequency, 5 times a week, and the other leg was trained 2 or 3 times a week. So literally it's like the legs are the twins. So it's the same person. So you can compare how well does the leg train 5 times a week. I think they did 3 sets of like 8 to 12, just knee extensions,
okay,
versus 2 or 3 times a week, the same volume per workout. So the one thing I don't like about this study, but it's kind of cool to have in there as well, is that there was a difference in volume. So they didn't try to equate the volume that the two legs underwent. For instance, by taking the 5 times a week volume and lumping that into 2 training sessions. They just kept the training session as a singular unit and compared 5 of those training sessions versus 2 or 3. And that's what that picture shows. Let me pull it up here on my end so I can point at whatever you guys might be seeing. So yeah, on the bottom says no difference in muscle growth.
Okay.
And one of the things they said, I have a quote there at the top, so thus there may be a quote ceiling effect for total training volume on the dose response relationship of the weekly sets, at least for untrained individuals. So basically this is something you see, it's one of the main limitations that will happen in studies where they use untrained subjects is they grow so easily.
Yeah.
So it's good. You get a nice positive training effect, but they were kind of growing maximally from just the 2 times a week training. And so adding more volume didn't do much for them.
Okay.
So that you didn't really get, and this is something I've talked about in other posts, sort of a full picture of what might be happening in terms of hormesis, meaning that imagine if they train those 5 times a week folks trained double the volume, they probably would have made lesser gain. It would have been too much. They would have been moving towards an overtraining phenomenon. Eventually, if they tried to do like, you know, 3 sessions a day, 5 times a week, that probably would have whacked them pretty bad. So you don't really see that, but so the thing essentially, so you look at that study, it's like, okay, so frequency doesn't matter. That's basically what you come up with. And that study doesn't point to 5 times being better than 2 or 3 times or 2 being better than 3 or anything like that. So they're kind of looking to kind of extend what has come about from some two of the meta-analyses that was done by Brad Schoenfeld, James Krieger, and those guys, showing that, you know, 2 is better than 1 and higher frequency might allow us to do a little more, add a little more volume in, but beyond like the 2 to 3 times per week, we really don't know. There's not enough data out there. So they did 2 and 3 and 5. So trying to add some data points to that higher frequency realm of the research. So here's the cool shit. So this is what I really like about what they did is they're like, okay, so let's take a closer look at our data. And the next one then is it's the pick that's more vertical. It's a change in CSA percentage on the left, Damas et al. 2019 follow-up analysis.
Got it. All right. Give me just a second. I think I got this one right here. Boom. All right. We're up.
Yeah. So this is what's really cool. So they basically just – they lump together the 2 and 3 times a week just for the sake of simplicity. Sorry, I cut off a little of my text there. But those are the individual data points with high frequency on the left and then the line connecting the data point for the same individual in the other leg, which was trained either 2 or 3 times depending on the person. So first thing is look on the very bottom left. You see an inverted open triangle there.
Okay.
And like right at that dotted zero line.
Yeah.
And so that person high frequency, they basically got zero change in cross-sectional area at high frequency. If you follow that line off to the right, you see the lower frequencies and basically it was zilch as well. That person was not doing well. They basically were a non-responder in both legs.
Okay.
Both cases. Now look up top, like look on the far upper right and you'll see one person there with, looks like it's a kind of an open, partially open square and on the lower frequencies column. That person gained over 25% increase in quad cross-sectional area. That would have been highly visible.
Huh, wow.
I don't know how big they were to start, but that's just tremendous. I've seen in individuals like 20% who are pretty muscular, and it's like, holy fucking shit.
Yeah.
That's a lot of muscle growth. You're like, wow, like total, like that's moving up like 2 weight classes in the course of a year.
That's crazy. Muscle growth. Yeah.
So that person – and if you follow that square, follow the line down to the higher frequency, it wasn't as good. They're more like about 20%, but still that person kicked butt.
Yeah.
Both legs grew well. So that person would have been what you might call an extreme responder.
Okay.
And then so now just look at the dots on the left and the high frequency, and then on the right, the lower frequency, and you'll notice the directionality of the lines. Some of them go from low to high.
Right.
High frequency being lesser growth and lower frequency being greater growth. And some of them slant down the other direction. That's because some people grew better with high frequency training than they did with low frequency training.
Huh.
And some people grew better with low frequency training than they did with high frequency training.
Okay. So this doesn't answer anything. It just raises more questions.
it answers exactly what bodybuilders have known for forever. It doesn't tell us how to pick. That's the thing. It doesn't tell us how to know what to do, except you have to get in there and try it. I mean, I would love to see someone. It would be very interesting to see someone actually replicate this on themselves. You could. Huh. You know, this you literally reminds me, man. Train this way. Yeah.
It reminds me. I had a knee surgery, and when I did – they told me I had to build the strength up in my legs first. I had to do physical therapy before they could do the ACL reconstruction.
Prehab.
So they put me on a machine. It was a leg extension, and it looked like the Bionic Man. It was hooked up to charts and graphs and stuff. And when I pressed, it put an isometric tension against me, and it was hard to push up, and it would begin to eventually start moving. And you could see the charts moving. And he said, okay, now I want you to do 3 months of physical therapy, which I did. They had me train 3 times a week. And I went to U of M, University of Michigan, did this for three months. And I'll tell you what, Scott, because my legs, I think, have always been pretty good genetic growers.
Calves without a doubt.
quads not so bad either. I went back in and I didn't lift at the time very much. So I had a pair of shorts on, the same pair of shorts that I always wore for physical therapy. And when I came back to test again, my legs were stretching the shorts out. And I was so excited to sit down and test. And then the doctor looked at my legs and he was like, we don't even need to do the test. And I was like, what? But I was like planning to do the test. I never got to do the test again. But I feel like I would have been that guy but I don't know whether it was the amount of frequency or the fact that I just hadn't trained a lot before that, you know?
you would have, your dots would have been at the upper end probably on this plot for regardless of if it was high or low frequency.
So
if you've been a subject.
So you're saying, you know, my question then is, you know, I say it raises more questions because it doesn't tell me what to figure out. But the key is just to get in there and see for yourself is what you're saying.
Yes. Yes. Like stop. So often people will ask questions like, is this too many sets per week? You know, I can't remember where it was. It was somewhere on social media, but it was like, it may have been in the Advices Radio forum, actually. I'm a natural competitor. No, it was Sustainable Self-Development forum, Abel Kasaba, I think, I'm sure I'm saying his last name right. But it was – so follow-up to a post – a podcast that I'd done with him, I think. Maybe it was another one. And he said, I'm a 41-year-old lifetime natural competitor. Is 9 sets per week too much? Something like that. It was very generic. And I'm like, well, first of all, hopefully you've learned something over the course of your lifetime training as a natural that you would know that's the case. But I can't possibly know that.
Yeah.
And the data here are showing that you can't possibly know for an individual a black and white number of frequency per week or number of sets until they've gone in there and actually done it. And there's so many factors, you know, that are involved there with how much volume, how much frequency would be right for the person. But that's what's really cool is that – so if you look at this first study, people would say, well, you know, the scientists don't know. You know, I know – like someone might say, I know higher frequency works for me. I just know it does and I don't care what the science says. And that's what some studies might point out. There's no difference when it comes to frequency. But these scientists are doing really good work and they went and dug into their data. If you dig enough into the data, you will realize that the data are from people who are living in the same time, space, four-dimensional reality that you and I are when we go into the gym and train at Gold's or, you know, some underground gym someplace.
Yeah.
And those data will, if you look deep enough into them, reflect the same things that are going on for you and me and everyone else. Just have to look deep enough. And that's what they did. So they ran their first study and they're like, well, you know, it doesn't make a difference. There was a ceiling effect. It's a very good way to explain what was going on. But then they looked again and they said, some people grow better from high volume or higher frequency. Some people grow better from lower frequency. Some people just grow better than others.
Now, was there any kind of predictors? Like, did they come up with any of that? Could they tell us? No. Okay.
That's where we want to go. That's what I want to be able to do. You know, I mean, it's sort of like part of me wants to know it just out of pure curiosity sake. It'd be really cool. Like, so I go in and you get your genetic test. That's what the genetic tests are proffering. But I have not seen any data. This would be the perfect study to do that. They can literally do sort of a gene array analysis and just basically, which has been done. Stu Phillips has been involved with some of those sorts of things, do a proteomics or genomics type of study where they just look at everything and say, okay, what genes or what proteins that are expressed are predictive of someone who grows better from high versus low frequency. So you could literally go in and get your genetics tested, get your genome sequenced and figure out if they'd done those, if they had biopsies, for instance, here, they could actually do something like that with subject's permission and get an idea of like, okay, the people that grow best are the people who, for instance, and there are things we know, there's things called myomeres, which are RNA sequences that block expression of proteins from mRNAs. There's the satellite cell density. There's the IGF-1 release and release of mechano growth factor that stimulates better growth in individuals who are extreme responders, et cetera, et cetera. There's all sorts of kind of predictors, but no genetics, like nothing. It's all sort of after the fact, like this is what explains who grew the best, but we can't say, except I guess you could look at satellite cells. Yeah. You could do a singular bout and do those sorts of things. But you still have to do a biopsy. It's not as easy as just like, you know, taking a saliva swab to get the DNA and saying, this is the genetic profile of someone who's going to grow really well. So that's cool to know. It would be awesome to know. I mean, you can look down the road and say, well, you know, maybe we can even sort of, engineer this into people. that takes me off. There's a whole other topic that I want to go off to on that. That was a book that I've been listening to. Nick Bostrom's Super Intelligence.
Okay.
Great listen from what I've seen and heard from, for anyone who wants to get into it. He's talking about the idea of artificial intelligence and it's the threats it poses to the world. Hmm. He goes off on a little bit of a tangent at one point in time. He talks about some of the things that could be done with iterative selection of fertilized eggs, fertilized gametes, where you basically sort of, and there's movies that have done this, I can't remember the name of them, but you basically would have, you would select for the genes in a fertilized egg that are best predictive of high intelligence or large muscle mass or responsiveness to exercise stimuli or what have you. And you can do, you could do that with the right technology.
Yeah.
Such that he says, like, literally in a matter of just continually selecting, basically what they do when they, you breed animals, you know, you pick that are best or breed dogs or what have you. Yeah. You select, you could do that with fertilized ova and stem cells and let them continue, just keep on selecting the ones that have the best DNA profile, given what you know. Huh. And a matter of a couple of years, he was saying you could create individuals who by the time when they're adults would you would expect to have intelligence that supersedes the intelligence of any human who's ever walked the face of the planet.
Holy shit. You can't tell me they're not trying that right now somewhere.
Oh, someone is. You know what I mean? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So
as far as sports, we could just go old school and just like get Iris Kyle and Ronnie Coleman to hook up.
Right. And
that's the old school way, you know?
That's literally what you do. You'd pick from the best specimens, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, obviously just ridiculous genetics. You know, Linda, maybe take Linda and Ronnie and, you know, and whoever else. Maybe toss Flex in there, and then you combine those in various ways and start selecting, and then allowing those cells to undergo mitosis and then keep on doing that. Huh. So that could be done, but it was just the time frame that he put forth. I can't confirm or deny that it was accurate enough, but it sounded like he knew what he was talking about, and I suspect he did. I don't have the actual physical book. There's probably some references in there that don't come across when you listen. But anyway, so that's kind of cool stuff, and it'd be cool to know. But the bottom line for people listening now is that you can figure this shit out on your own. Like, I mean, most people who grow really well, like most people who are IFBB pros, they distance themselves from their peers really, really quickly. They know, you know, they go in with their buddies and they start training, and they're all like, they all start off benching, and when they all get 135, that's awesome. And then, you know, the guy who ends up being a good competitor, wins the state show, et cetera, he's benching 2.25
right
2 months later, and then 275, and then he gets on the sauce and he's doing 365, and his buddies are still trying to do 205.
Right, right.
Oh, they're not even at 2.25 yet.
I always think of the Dave Henry story. You know, Scott, we train the same. We eat the same foods.
I don't get it.
Why don't you look like I do?
I know, exactly.
I'll never forget that one. I can just imagine the look on your face, guy. So, guys, if you hadn't heard, Dave Henry and Scott obviously have known each other for years and years, and Scott's coached him. And Dave turns to him one day while they're training, and he says that. They're looking in the mirror at each other, you know, posing. And it's like, huh. Scott, I'm sure you were just thinking to yourself, man, Dave, I've been thinking that every day of my life that we trained together.
Well, we were both pre-contest, and it was after a training session and after we're just exhausted, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So he said it, and he was just like, just this free-form ad lib, you know, that just kind of came out of his mouth. And it didn't even like hit me. It wasn't in any way a slight.
No.
So I didn't take it as that. I'm like, yeah, Dave. I'm hoping to at least win my weight class in my state show, and you're the reigning Mr. Olympia in the 202.
Right.
There's a little we had of a difference between the two of us.
Yeah.
But the same thing comes to frequency here for individuals who are listening to this who are not sure whether or not they should try a higher frequency or lower frequency approach. They may be someone. I mean, if you look at the plot here, there are some people for whom the line is pretty much straight across. So the change in cross-sectional area here is equal for the high and the low frequency legs. And then some people, there's a pretty substantial slant in that line.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, well, there's one person here. Here's like this, about the second greatest change in cross-sectional area for the high frequency. It's up there, you know, about 22 or so. And if you look at the lower frequency, they got like a 7% increase in quad cross-sectional area.
Yeah,
tremendous. So that person is definitely getting a sub, at least, you know, as an untrained person in the first few months of training, getting a suboptimal dose from that frequency and or that volume.
So what's
when they train two or three times a week?
What's the key here then? So I know that you're telling me that what you have to do is get in the gym and just try it. I feel like the thing that holds us, there's a lot of things that hold us back. I know that for myself, one of them is that, you know, it, as in bodybuilding, we gravitate toward our routine and to what we're comfortable with. I've talked with you for literally years now on this podcast, and it took me a long time to change my training split to a higher frequency training split. And I can say that in the last 5 years, that is the best change that I have made. That making that decision, that's the biggest change in my training in the last 5 years that I've made. But to get there, to take it from like, okay, yeah, Scott makes a good point, maybe that could work, from getting there to actually applying it and then actually seeing the results. I mean, that was there's a lot of time that went in between. What can you suggest to people here today to adapt to this? Let's bring this to like the real world, because there's a lot of people out there that are saying like, man, this makes awesome sense. And then guess what? They're going to turn this podcast off. They're going to go to the gym and they're going to keep doing what they've always done.
Right.
You know,
this comes down to literally, it's a function of adherence. And most of the time you hear adherence, people are just people that are even just exercising or not exercising. But when it comes to people who are training and they have a way that they like to train and they have, it's, there's some reward that comes immediately from the way they train, it's hard to break that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
literally, I mean, the bottom line is going to, and I heard, I'm going to slaughter his name, but Borga Fairley, B-O-R-G-E.
Okay.
Used to go by Blade many years ago on the boards a long time ago, but Borga, B-O-R-G-E. And he has his stance. He's the one to come up with MyoReps. Have you heard of MyoReps?
No, I haven't.
Okay. So people who follow, it's a cluster set technique.
Okay.
So I mention it now and again in that context. Great guy. Very, very smart guy. And he's really kind of come in this interview, he was really focusing on, it just kind of comes down to what you really like to do. You want to do something that kind of optimizes everything, but if it's just pure torture, you know, for some way, if you just hate to have to go into the gym and like be anxious all day long about doing a big heavy squat that day or what have you, even though that might give you an extra, you know, 5 or 8 pounds of muscle at the end of the road at some point, then you're not going to do it. It's not going to work for you. So you have to kind of do that, figure out that whether what you're willing to do. And then I think the trick, the key, and this is why I'm so happy that Fortitude Training has kind of worked out the way it has. And I built this into the program intentionally, kind of knowing this, is that people think it's fun. Mm. They enjoy the training. They're like having fun with the training. And that's the variety of it.
Ah.
So in this case, like if someone, let's say, we can take different examples and break this down and make it more specific rather than just sort of talk globally. If someone's been training like with kind of a bro split, you know, you know, once a week, what have you. Blitzy? No. She's getting ready to go. then they would, if they go to a higher frequency, let's say they start training everything twice a week.
Okay.
And they just go to a push pull legs or something along those lines, then adding some variety in can make that more fun. Literally adding different set types, like I have in Fortitude Training. So we're going to do muscle rounds, or we're going to do rest pause sets, or we're going to do high reps on one day and low reps on the other day. Whatever the person likes to do, so that it's entertaining and fun, and there's a little bit of spice in the training. So that it's not like, oh shit, like you definitely wouldn't want to make it all, each training session sort of identical. maybe once a week. Like, let's say you don't like training legs, but you know, I got to get legs done, and I do okay training once a week. So I go in and do my squats, I do my leg press, I do my knee extension, hamstring curls, stiff legged deadlifts, blah, blah, blah. Like, I can just get through that. And then I have like 6 days, I don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. That's kind of tolerable for someone. Mm-hmm. But if you'd have to go in and like do that same leg routine twice a week.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my God. Like, it's like eating the same breakfast that you really are kind of like, yeah, I don't like that so much, but I can put up with it once a week all the time.
I gotcha.
So in shifting to a higher frequency approach, the variety, I think, is actually absolutely paramount. So I like to have progressive overload. So somewhat, and obviously that's what you've been doing now, and posting about on Instagram, which is really cool with like the incline dumbbell presses.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been fun too, man. It's a fun challenge. I'm going to tell you, Scott, this last time that I went in, I was a little scared because I started it with like the 90s, 95s, and I worked my way up, and then I got up to the 110s, and then I felt like, okay, this is really heavy. And I know that I could spend time with these now. And now I'm not going to increase the weight, but I'm going to increase the quality of the reps and then increase the reps from there. So I still feel like that's progressive, you know?
Absolutely.
And so that's my new goal now, is to stay with the 110s. But even that, man, I got the 110s when I was out in Vancouver. And then I had to train chest again when I came home. And in that next workout, it was one of those days too, where like the weights felt heavy. Like I picked up the 55s. And I'm like,
it feels like a 65.
Exactly. Or a 70. And I'm like, man, right. I don't. And there's part of me in my head is going like, I don't know if you can do this, Scott. I don't know if you can do this today. But I'm thinking like, I got to do, but I got it up and I managed to get one more rep out. And I feel that my form was a little bit better than it had been before. But I'm going to tell you, man, it was kind of a scary set. And it's the first time I'd really been scared in a while. I really questioned, like, am I going to be able to get this today? And I liked that too. I'm not going to lie, man. I liked that challenge, you know?
Yeah. So, and one thing you can do in that regard, and then I built this into my program too. It's easy just to refer back to that, is that I have different volume tiers that one would auto-regulate on a particular day. So let's say, you know, you typically do two heavy compound chest exercises and two isolation for the volume tier you typically do. You're like, fuck, I don't know if I can. I can do one, but I don't, that second one, I'm just – it's not feeling that shit today. So you can still get high quality training stimulus from dropping down a volume tune and doing less. So you just do the one all out set and make that it. And that is that's bite size. It's tolerable.
Gotcha. So,
like, if you had come in the next time you train chest feeling that way that you did that day where you're a little bit scared and just it was always like that, eventually that would peter out. That's not sustainable.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. But if you have the options, like, okay, today's a little bit off, you know, maybe it was just a deload would be an option, but I'm going to drop down and instead, you're just doing the one set, but let's say you had two sets, you could just drop down to one set or you could change things. Yeah. Or maybe it's just every other day. You know, you might say, you know, have an option. Like, today's going to be a day when I increase the reps and I choose different types of exercises.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes
whatever the sort of system is. Yeah. So
to keep it fun and to not be perpetually scared, I guess. And I guess, you know what it is for me, Scott, is that I found that I see that this could be like, to me, I guess the most important thing is that I make progress. And so because of that, I like the idea. But I guess it took wrapping my head around that about like, well, this is the best way for me to make progress now. And I truly believe that in my heart. And so for me, it's a training plan that works. So I guess, you know, maybe like you said, fundamentally people might not like the idea, but like, you know, I think of like, remember we were talking before about how Jordan Peters and Sasan were great training partners for a while, but then Sasan got really burnt out with it. And he said he began to like, really feel uncomfortable and he loathed the training and he was unhappy. Right. But Sasan could really grow pretty damn well without training that way too, though. I mean, he grew well doing it, but he grew well obviously before he did that. You know, he was already a fantastic bodybuilder and he could probably continue to be a fantastic bodybuilder without it. A guy like me, who's probably like more like 95% of the people who are watching this, I don't have any other fucking options at this point. Right. You know what I mean?
Right. Yes.
It's like, I'm going to have to do something, you know, and it's like you were talking about on the Mind Pump episode. You know, you said that there's back in the day in the 90s or the 2000s, everybody was doing the bro split five, you know, one time a week. And for the genetically superior, it seemed to work really well. But mm-hmm. for other guys, they might not have gotten, you said, like, you know, the same hormonal response just training once a week. And so it's almost like, I feel like going to this multiple times a week system, for me at least, it's like I'm hacking that. Maybe Sasan doesn't need to hack muscle growth, but I need to hack muscle growth to get that response high enough, you know, on a regular basis to grow. At least that's my guess. That's my theory, you know?
Well, it was growth factors, not hormones. That's a whole other thing.
Is it? Okay, so I used the wrong term. Factors. Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. Because people are like, oh, he subscribes to the hormone hypothesis, and I don't. Like, that's been disproved. But it's the growth factors. Which MGF, for instance.
Yeah.
So, but the thing, it's awesome that you bring up Sasan, because he was a phenomenal bodybuilder, training the way he had, kind of like instinctively, just kind of going to town. And actually, when James came on the It's Just Bodybuilding and talked about how James Hollingshead, and talked about how he had been training, he was just like, he didn't know what the fuck he was doing. You know, he was just going, but he ended up getting his pro card, I think, or at least winning his class at the Brits doing that. So, but Sasan then training, you know, all out in a way that he was making progress, I think, above and beyond what he had previously in training with Jordan.
Absolutely.
He was really growing. So he did have a better training stimulus, but it wasn't better in that he could sustain it. And this is the same situation that someone without Sasan's genetic gifts might be in, where they recognize that maybe higher frequency training or more progressive overload training might be better for them, but it's the amount to which they can add that in and still enjoy what they're doing and still continue to do that. So you're like, I realize I have to do this in order to grow because of my genetics aren't great. And so you're like, you're intrinsically motivated, internally motivated to go after that.
Yeah.
So you want to make that happen. And some people might be quite as convinced about that.
Which there was a time I wasn't.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And it took you a long time to do that. So like the intermediate step would be like, well, let me try this out. There's various ways you could do it. I could say, I'm going to just give myself 6 months and just, you know, totally switch to something else and hopefully not just follow it blindly. Or I can incorporate this to some degree. And people do this all the time with fortitude training. They'll add one of the training techniques or some aspect of it into their program. They don't completely, you know, jump ship from what they have found has been working, but they add something that makes sense to them in the amount that works for them. So
that they're comfortable with. When you say that works for them, that they're comfortable with. Yeah.
That well, it works for them hopefully over the long haul in terms of muscle growth, but that is sustainable.
Yeah.
They'll keep doing it and not be like, ah, fuck this, you know, and not want to do it. So they just go, if you go too far in, it just doesn't match your personality. And some people just don't want to train like in HIT, DC training, Yates, Jordan, fortitude training style, where you're just pushing a large majority of your sets to at least a failure point or very, very close. Some people want to just train with higher volume, you know, and leave more reps in the tank.
Yeah.
So,
hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of Muscle Minds with Dr. Scott and myself. A couple of things. Number one, if you ever go to YouTube, please subscribe to our page. The more numbers we can get, the more people that we will reach, the better it is for the YouTube algorithm. So thank you to everybody who has subscribed. And if you are enjoying our content over there, then that's awesome. I'm really glad that we can add the video stuff. In fact, as you guys probably hear, this episode has some video features to it, you know, charts and graphs and stuff that Scott's been putting up, which is really cool. And I'm really having fun with this episode, by the way, if you can't tell. This is like what podcasting is all about. You know, I worked my blue collar day job for years, listening to podcasts and educating myself along the way. And it really has helped me become the coach that I am today. So I'm really grateful that we can put shows together like this. And if you guys want to get more awesome information, then check out Scott's book, Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach, BYOBBcoach.com. You can get the ebook there. You can also go to Barnes & Noble or Amazon to purchase the hardcover. Seriously, this is, if you bought one book to teach yourself more about bodybuilding this year or ever, really, this would be right up there as a top book to recognize as like the Bible, I'll call it, of teaching you just so much about every aspect
of off season through prep and even more. Guys, while I've got you, I just want to mention True Nutrition. I mean, really, I couldn't find a sponsor that was more aligned with the message that we try to promote. I am so grateful that we can work with True Nutrition. I'm grateful for them every day. So thank you very much, Dante Trudell, and thank you, True Nutrition. Guys, high quality supplements. This is a company that's made for bodybuilders by bodybuilders. These are people that want to give you the best product that they can without all the frills and the bells and whistles. So they don't spend all their money on fancy, you know, packages and advertising. They just put their money into high quality products. This really is the best stuff that you can get. And yeah, use our code ADVICES. Let them know that you support what we're doing. Let's them know that the message is getting heard. And thank you to everybody who is using our code and shopping with True Nutrition. All right, guys, thanks for listening to me ramble. Let's get back to Scott.
But that, so that's, so if someone wants to increase frequency, most, it's like, it would be so rare. I'm trying to think if I've known anyone who was doing high frequency that then reverted back to like kind of a bro split to lower frequency. That's hardly ever happens.
I could see that. Yeah.
Yeah. One way to do that either direction would be simply to, take a muscle group and just stop training that as frequently or more frequently. So it's just basically make the change to one parameter of your program, just how you train one or two muscle groups. So if you're doing like everything split up over 5 days or what have you, you might have like every third day repeat a chest workout. Mm. So intersperse, you know, add chest in, you know, twice a week. Yeah. And see what happens with chest.
Which makes sense because, and that's exactly, you know, as you know, that's what I did. Out of necessity, you know, because I had I was getting tendonitis issues in my bicep when I trained 5-6 exercises of chest in one day. So I did half of it one day, half the other. If you're already doing a bro split, that makes total sense because you're going to have one day that's going to be like shoulders only. You could easily do chest on one day and then chest and shoulders on the other day. Something like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like there's going to be space where you could fit that in to do two exercises for chest on another day, you know?
Yeah. And it's not, I don't think it's coincidental that very often the first thing people think of when coming up with strategies to increase a weak body part is to train it more frequently. Mm. You know, that seems to work a lot of times. It's not always the answer. If you're training, poor training is going to get poor adaptation. If your training sucks and you're not able to focus with a good mind muscle connection on the muscle you're trying to hit, then doing more of that's probably not going to help. But the higher frequency is the thing that has worked for many people. It's just that a lot of people don't want to do that for everything. They don't want to train legs 3 times a week, for instance, they just don't. So, and that's fine. That would be silly to try to do that. It would be like, it's not optimal if you don't train. It might be an optimal training system if you could hypnotize yourself into, you know, doing that and liking it. But if you don't like it, you're not going to do it. So it doesn't matter.
And the key is recovery, right? At the end of the day, absolutely. Like you need to still recover no matter how many times you're hitting it, right?
Yeah. And the thing that's interesting, like that occurred to me is one of the things that I love to see investigated more that I think plays a big role is that the evidence kind of suggests if you look at like the relative increase in collagen protein synthesis or connective tissue protein synthesis, it's much less than that of muscle protein synthesis. And a lot of people they end up being sort of limited by connective tissue, tendonitis, inflammation, those sorts of things. So it may be that in your case, like one of the reasons why you did better with taking that volume and spreading it out is that rather you were with that larger training volume on that one day, you were so superseding what your connective tissue could handle. You were just tearing down so much connective tissue that you end up obviously causing an inflammatory response there, but your connective tissue was able to kind of keep up with the pace of training by doing less more frequently, and that in and of itself, even if there was nothing about the higher frequency, per se, but just allowed you to train with, let's say, a total of 20 sets, 10 on one day, 10 on another day, without getting tendonitis.
Yeah.
If you can do that for a year, it's much better than doing 20 sets on one day when you get tendonitis and have to like stop training 2 months every 6 months out of the year.
Absolutely.
So chest picking the right training approach that allows you to continue to train can be, make sense psychologically, but also make sense physiologically too, like when it comes to connective tissue.
Yeah, I can see that.
So we've got – how much time we got? I know you
got
to
– We got as much time – we have – well, we technically – I have an hour and a half until I need to start the next show. So,
gotcha. Yes. I couldn't remember. So the other topic is the low versus high carb.
All right.
And this one has a little – there's a little bit more that – and this is – I'm going to speculate some on this, but it's very – I mentioned this in my Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach book because it's where some of these data at that time. But very, very cool stuff. So we got another figure I think we can pull up. This one will be – it says lowest carb on the left, upper left, lowest carb. This is A to Z study in the upper left corner, individual data.
Got it.
Yeah. So a guy by the name of Gardner has done a good bit of this research, and he's got a, the title of the paper that he wrote is Tailoring Dietary Approaches for Weight Loss, published in 2013. So there was a study in 2007 called the A to Z study, and that's what you see depicted here. In this case, the individual data. So what they initially did was they had a number of subjects. Gosh, you can see by if you just counted the bars in each of those, the number of subjects that that followed each of these different dietary approaches. Atkins, Zone, I guess that's why they come with A to Z. The Learn diet and the Ornish diet.
Okay.
So the Learn diet is sort of more of a higher carb type of diet. The Ornish diet was like lots of fruits and vegetables. The Zone diet is Barry Sears, you know, kind of splitting things into thirds. And Atkins was a keto diet. Okay. So when they ran the comparisons on the weight loss in these obese individuals that carried out this study, I think it was women, basically it was pretty much the same. There was a little bit of an advantage for Atkins, actually, in the case of this study. And I'm not going to make much of that because that doesn't pan out in a lot of the studies. You just really – if you look at the data as a whole, you don't see low-carb winning out over higher-carb, generally speaking. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes it's the other way around, which doesn't surprise me, actually. But it's interesting. You actually can see if you look at those data like look at the uppermost set of bars there next to the Atkins. And you can see the kilograms of loss. So at the leftmost, you've got the same thing. That leftmost bar is nearly 30 kilos lost by this individual. And if you look at the right, there's some people that actually gained it's like 7 or 8 kilos on the diet.
Yeah.
So,
gosh, somebody really got screwed on that Zone diet. They look like they gained a lot. That one person at the far end.
Right. Like that that was not a good choice for that person.
No. But it looks like for the most part, the majority of people made progress on all the diets.
Yeah, they did. And that was what happened. But it was only like, we're talking like 3 or 5 kilos on average.
Okay. Yeah.
You don't see like this, you know, like less than 10 pounds. But you see tremendous variability. So the same thing. We've seen in the other study, which I've mentioned time and time again, you see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. And you can kind of see if you look at the Atkins there, like at the point of zero, no weight gain or weight loss is kind of further to the right. Mm-hmm. More people are on you have more bars on the left. There's kind of a greater area if you add up all the area of those bars on the left for weight loss. And that kind of that makes you want to predict that what they actually found was that Atkins was a little bit superior, but no big deal there. So Gardner went back and looked at several studies. There are 3 studies that he reviews in that paper, and then he looked and reanalyzed the A to Z study. And when he looked at all those data, you see an interesting thing kind of crop its head. And it's – I'm not going to say that this – people are going to say, oh, this is supportive of the insulin hypothesis. I've never heard anyone actually say that. I'm surprised it's never come up. Because this is, you know, this is a is an anchor point for which people could anchor their belief that insulin levels are what's most important for fat loss, because insulin promotes lipogenesis, inhibits lipolysis. So like people who are big on low carb keto will say like it's all a matter of insulin, blah blah blah. And I don't think that's the case. It's just too much. The system is just too complex to anchor it all onto one hormone. But interestingly enough, when he looked those three studies that are mentioned in the paper, when he analyzed the A to Z study again, comparing the Atkins with the Ornish, so he took the lowest carb keto and the Ornish, which is a pretty high carb approach, and they have made various measures of insulin sensitivity in those studies. So they try to measure everything they can to see if there's anything that's predictive. It turns out that for individuals who at the beginning of the weight loss, or the fat loss period, are the least insulin sensitive, they tend to do best over time with what you consider an insulin sensitizing diet, a low carb diet. So if you're insulin insensitive, the best way to improve insulin sensitivity is to remove insulin or remove carbohydrate.
Right. That makes sense.
And as it turns out, that ends up being from those three studies and the A to Z reanalysis. What happens is that the people with who are insulin insensitive do lose the most fat when they go with a low carb approach. And the opposite is also true to a certain degree as well. So if someone is already has decent insulin sensitivity, a high carb approach works well for them. Maybe even better than a low carb approach.
Okay.
So that's really pretty freaking bad. That basically, if you just take that as like a black and white, as a guideline, that tells you that if someone comes to you really out of shape, or if someone has a family proclivity for diabetes, or they have a lot of body fat, they're going to have poor insulin sensitivity. You can measure insulin sensitivity, or you can get an estimate of it if you basically take blood glucose and they multiply that by resting fasted insulin levels. And it's an HOMA, homeostatic method of analysis of insulin sensitivity. That can be done easily with regular blood work. That will tell you whether someone might do better with a low-carb approach versus a high-carb approach.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's funny because, I mean, the guiding principle there would be if you're insulin insensitive, then pick the diet that will improve your insulin sensitivity. And that's what those data seem to show.
Which also would show that you could probably your diet strategy may change depending where you're at, right? Because you could take a guy you could take a guy who was very insulin resistant and get him insulin sensitive, and then he's going to need something different.
That's the leap that I was thinking about, that I had this all written up for Instagram for those who are watching, and Instagram just wouldn't let me post it.
Well, maybe you'll get it up before the show's
I'm going to figure it out,
okay,
man.
Okay.
Just restart my computer 95 times until eventually it works.
Right.
I just have to resize those pictures. I couldn't do it on my phone because it wouldn't size them to show the full plots. So let me follow with this.
Yeah.
Say it's the important, interesting thing. They did another study, and there was one genetic marker related to variations in the gene for insulin receptor substrate 1. So one of the things when insulin binds to its receptor, there's something known as insulin receptor substrate 1, which is one of the signal transducers that tells the cell to do what insulin's telling it to do. So it's an important molecule in transducing the binding of insulin to its receptor to the intracellular events like depositing fat or inhibiting lipolysis or what have you. So there was a little bit of an idea that maybe there's some genetics involved. So Gardner did a follow-up study, and that's that last plot, which we can probably throw up.
All right.
Pardon the pun.
Let me see. I think I got it here. Is this the one with the circles on it?
Yeah, that's the one.
All right.
So they did like a huge study, and it took quite a while. They weren't able to get all the data initially because they didn't have funding, but eventually they gathered funding. And they compared a healthy low-fat with a healthy low-carbohydrate diet and looked for that same effect. Is there something to do with – can we look at insulin sensitivity initially as a predictor of efficacy of the diet? Or are there genetics that we might – if we looked in the literature that might be predictive in some way, shape, or form? And they didn't find anything. So they got a little more detailed – and said, okay, we think this is a real effect. Let's dig in on it and do a specific study, a low-carb versus a high-carb study. And so what I did is like, oh, how low-carb did they go? The interesting thing here is they were comparing a diet which was about 25 versus about 50% carbs, or 200 grams a day versus 100 grams a day.
Okay.
That's not a big difference.
Okay.
In my opinion, the way I'm thinking of it, that's not, it's not like zero carbs. If they had compared an Atkins, then maybe they would have found something. That's what they did with that reanalysis of the A to Z study, where they compared Atkins with the Ornish.
Mm.
Zero carbs, essentially, or very, very low with a very, very high carb. So the data aren't absolutely 100% conclusive. But interestingly enough, there does seem to be something there. So I don't know. We'll see. I think it makes sense. If you find – and the data aren't always conclusive to this effect either. Sometimes as long as you're in a caloric deficit and someone's exercising, you're going to get improvements in insulin sensitivity, whether it's low carb or high carb. If you go down to like 1,000 calories a day, you know, whether or not those – you've got your protein in place, whether you're all carbs otherwise or all fat otherwise, that's such a caloric deficit, you're going to have an improvement in insulin sensitivity. That's maybe not any different. But I think it does make sense to some degree, because this is what works well for diabetes, is to go with a lower carb approach for someone who is has poor insulin sensitivity. That would be the person who – they know this from – they did a HOMA test, insulin – measure fasted insulin and fasted blood glucose, or they've got lots of body fat, or they got a family history of diabetes or what have you, and then try a lower carb approach. And that might be physiologically, because remember, these studies were pick the diet you think you like the best, which is what people do in real life.
Yeah.
You know, they pick the diet that's been marketed to them the best.
Right.
Or they pick the diet that their buddy's doing. Or, you know, my friend said, I just eat peanut butter crackers all day long and I'm going to lose weight better than anything. And she looks awesome. So I'm going to do what she did.
Yeah. Yeah.
Her whole face and her skin is orange now from the peanut butter crackers. But, you know, she looks great otherwise.
I heard about this diet called the TED diet.
That was awesome.
long time ago, guys. You'd have to. Yes. We should re-bring that one up sometime. Yeah. Didn't work. Ted never lost fat, huh?
Ted did not. I don't think he stuck to it for very long. I don't think he did it for all that.
Okay.
It was only a matter of a few weeks, but God, it was fun to watch him. Oh, man. Well, I think it was 10 minutes. Well, let's talk about that. Well, fuck it. We'll just go into it. So this guy, Ted, who was the boyfriend of one of our babysitters, yes.
We get the Ted story. The
Ted diet. So yeah, Ted, I haven't told this for a while. So I got to watch him do this one time. So he figured, you know, he has a hard time with calorie control and you know, he just couldn't keep himself from eating. So he's like, I'm going to just allow myself free reign to eat whatever the hell I want, as long as I limit the time that I can do this. So it's kind of like a skip load in a way. We'll call it a TED load.
You were a little kid, you said, at the time, right?
I was probably like 10, something like that. You know, we had needed babysitters when my parents would go on vacations or what. I think sometimes they'd go to like golfing tournaments. My dad would play golf and mom would travel. And so they'd watch us in the summers.
So Ted told you about the diet? Like he explained this to you, 10-year-old kid?
Yeah, well, we'd be gone. Ted was highly corruptive. Ted and one of his best friends were great. They were awesome. So Tina was her name and Ted was her boyfriend. And sometimes she had to go do things, you know, because they would be watching us. Sometimes it'd be like a whole week.
Yeah.
There was this one golf tournament that lasted the whole week. So Ted, we get passed off to Ted now and again, and he'd take us over to his, I think it was dad's place. This is where I remember this happening was his dad had a ranch, lived out in the country. And, he would have gone shopping and he stocked everything up. So basically Ted would set out before him all the foods that he's been craving and allow himself a 10-minute period to eat whatever the hell he wanted.
Naturally. Yeah.
And usually it was ice cream and I just remember like just bowing down ice cream and him getting like the brain freeze from trying to eat the chocolate caramel ice cream too fast, you know, and then he tried to like mix in some other junk food, cookies and shit, you know. And it was just like this really what I would probably think is pretty pitiful, you know, food fest for 10 minutes. And it did not work for him. But I don't think he did it for very long. But
that's all he ate, you said, too, right?
That was it. The 10 minutes. He had a 10-minute feeding window.
Yeah.
That was it. Like it was like the skip load, you know, the hours. And of course you eat other meals, I think, during that time. But
right.
This was no food other than the 10-minute Ted Lode window.
Wow. Wow.
And yeah, it's just, it was awesome. They used to, like, he and his friend, they would do prank phone calls while we got to listen. And his friend was just a genius at this. Of course, this is my perception as a kid.
Right.
And he would, like, the one I remember him doing, because I ended up doing this later when I got to the age where I would do these sort of things, he would call people up and he'd say, yes, ma'am, this is John Smith from the Quincy Fire Department. We have heard wind of a gas leak in your neighborhood, and we're trying to figure out where the gas leak might occur. I wonder if you maybe could help us out a little bit with this issue, and be like, you know, it's like, of course. Well, what can I do? It's like, well, do you smell any gas currently? You smell like someone might have farted in your house, something like that. You know, it's like this little weird thing, you know, and like, no, it's like, ma'am, do you smell farts? No, don't smell farts. Okay. He would just take this. He could keep a person on the phone for half an hour, have them wandering around the house. We had one woman put her head in her oven. She had a gas oven, put her head in the oven. And he's like, ma'am, we need to know if the gas is on. Can you turn the oven on?
Oh, my God.
He's like, no, never mind. Don't do that. She was going to turn the oven on while her head was in the oven, smelling for gas. So anyway, like those guys, we used to do all sorts of crazy stuff.
You made it through all that, too. You made it through that.
Here I am. So anyway, we're not talking about so far the A to Z diet has not the TED diet has not been tested.
Okay.
In terms of whether or not it's better to have high or low insulin sensitivity to get the best effects from the TED 10-minute TED load diet.
Yeah.
But it does sort of make sense that someone might do that. But here's the thing: the bottom line down always comes down to what diet is the person going to be able to stick with, you know? Mm. That's the bottom line. You know, and fruits and vegetables are not bad for you. So having some carbs, like going right off the bat into like an Atkins style, like zero fruits and vegetables diet might not be the best choice for someone necessarily. But a low glycemic low diet does seem to make sense. And those other studies that the Gardner reviews in that paper, we're basically looking at high versus lower glycemic load, and that does make a difference in terms of insulin sensitivity.
Okay. So looking at this compared to now, when you said training, you just have to get in there and try it to see what's best for you. Here we do have some predictors. You said insulin sensitivity would be a predictor as to what type of diet may work better for you. Are there any other predictors that this shows or that you could think of that we haven't talked about here? Anything else that we could say, hey, this would be another factor?
Well, the things that are associated with poor insulin sensitivity.
Okay.
So you measure that with blood work or just having high body fat. And exactly what you said, like that was that insight was the one that I had, is that here's the thing, and this is what I'll post once I get the Instagram post up, is that when someone starts off their diet, and there's kind of two ways to look at this. One, if you're a bodybuilder who's been pushing, you don't have to do much in order to reverse and start losing body fat. One of the things that I would do in years when I would just be pushing my calories up is I literally would just make sure my protein was the same, and I would just eat according to my appetite.
Yeah.
So if I were at 6,000 calories, my appetite would put me down at like 4,000 or 4,500. Just wouldn't, like, you know, gorge myself, and the fat loss would come really pretty fast that way. I would actually feel better. Probably my NEAT would go up because I'm not feeling like, you know, I'm just constantly bloated all day long.
Right.
So I'd be more active and have a greater expenditure relative to my intake. But if someone is not sure what to do and you're kind of trapped with higher body fat, say it's a new client for someone, for instance, who's a trainer, the thought that if someone has a lot of body fat, it might make sense to at least diet them to the point where you get to their insulin sensitivity under control. So you can measure that with blood work potentially, or simply body fat. So bring them down to lower levels of body fat. And here's what I think is potentially something that's worth checking into for a certain subset of people is it seems like if you have higher insulin sensitivity, you might actually do better with more carbs.
Hmm.
Of course, you have to have a caloric deficit in place. Otherwise, the diet's not going to work. So someone might start off a diet simply by reducing the carbohydrate to increase insulin sensitivity. You don't have to go right to an Atkins. Go too fast and you'll just drop weight too fast. You don't want to do that necessarily, especially if you've just gotten some new muscle. And then for those people who don't do really well with low carb diets when they're getting down to like the 6 week, 8 week, 4 week, 2 week out thing, they actually, this information suggests that some of those folks might be okay with more carbs. And literally, like, instead of like going with a like a zero carb approach, allow the carbs to stay in, keep the caloric deficit. That's going to help with replenishing glycogen, potentially help with training. So it's possible that you can do better even when you're insulin sensitized and you're dieted down with a higher relative carb approach.
I can see that.
But that's what this kind of says, is that literally you'd start with get insulin sensitivity under control, and then as you get more leaner and leaner and leaner, you could actually start increasing your carb intake, relatively speaking, or at least don't cut it down too far. One of the things that I found, maybe you found this with clients too, is that like the 100 grams a day range is like a no man's land. And you're like, you feel like you can kind of go in and out of ketosis.
Yeah. I could see that.
You're starting to adapt to low carb, but you're not quite there. So some people just say, fuck it. And they just drop the carbs down except for trace carbs from like nuts and some veggies and that kind of thing. And they do better. They feel better, as opposed to like the 100, 150 grams where they're just kind of like, they still have a carb cravings. They're probably getting a little bit of ghrelin release. And it's just like, there's a point where it's like, you got to like pick a side, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so that is an issue that people can run into. If they were down at like 50 grams and they try to go like to 100, then there's like just a matter of how you feel. And I'm guessing as to why that is.
Yeah.
Like that you're maybe sometimes shifting in and out of ketosis, depending on how big the person is. And if they've been previously keto adapted, I think there's probably some epigenetic changes that occur where you can get really good at being in ketosis if you've done a lot of low carb dieting. So they have to, you know, figure out. And there's also like, so now I'm at 100 grams of carbs a day, so I get some good carbs now and again. And it's kind of like here's the carrot. You can just have a little bitty bit of it, but not the whole thing. It's like, no, I don't even want to fucking see the carrot. Get the carrot out of my face. I don't want a dangling carrot of carbs.
Yeah.
Just no carbs. I'm going to enjoy, like, you know, all my meats and my cheeses and my sauces and my fatty sources. And I'll have carbs, you know, when I do a carb up on the weekend or what have you. So that no man's land place is not always a good one.
Yeah, I could see that.
But it's a new set of guidelines for some people who – you know, maybe would do better with more carbs. They might be able to do really, really well and still drop fat and not feel like, God, I'm just, I feel like shit without the carbs when I'm this dieted down. More carbs might help them.
You know what this reminds me of, Scott? There's been more than one case where I have worked with somebody, and I'll specifically say, like, let's use like a men's physique client. I've worked with a lot of men's physique guys. And I've had a lot of guys who've come to me that were new competitors, guys that had never really like quote unquote bulked. They had, you know, just been staying in like decent shape and growing along the way. And then they say, hey, I want to do a show. We do a show. And then we get them into incredible shape, let's say. Okay. And let's say that it wasn't a diet where they really had to struggle. We just took their diet and then we, you know, started adjusting it and we got some changes and we continued to do that for the next 16, 20 weeks, got them in really good shape. After that, they say, this is awesome. This next year, I'm going to put on as much muscle as possible and then we'll compete next year. They come back to me and they've eaten all of these carbs now for the last off season. And I believe this is what it comes down to, is that insulin sensitivity. They come back to me and then what it takes this next time, they may have gained some weight. They may be bigger now. They've also gained some body fat. They've also been eating God knows how many carbs. A guy who's under 200 pounds, he's eating like 600 carbs a day. And now what it takes to diet him is a completely different ball game than what it took that year before. I really do think I feel like that's reflective of what we're talking about here.
So his body fat is much higher at the starting point after that year of sort of crazy bulking.
Maybe we'll even say maybe not. He responded okay to the carbs. He didn't get to the point where he was really fat, but a guy who has been eating now a ton of carbohydrates, I can't just take that same diet that worked last year and make it work again. A lot of times I've seen like these same guys now, they've really got to grind. They've really got to get the carbs down low to get the same response. And I really feel like it's like they affected something with insulin sensitivity through that off season.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I've seen it a bunch of times.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that are involved. One, insulin sensitivity is a function of acute factors like what you've just eaten, what you've been eating for the last few days, and then obviously just your body fat and then your genetic proclivity. So, you know, someone could be eating a shitload of carbs. Someone could be relatively lean and they've been just like, you know, on a carb fest for several days and just been like constantly, you know, hyperglycemic all the time, and their insulin sensitivity could be pretty poor. But that if they're lean still, that would revert relatively rapidly if they just drop back to a regular normal, you know, eucaloric normal carbohydrate intake type of diet. But if someone has a lot of body fat, just having the body fat tends to make them to end up being more insulin insensitive.
So you think it's the body fat that caused these issues? I mean, you're just guessing, of course, because these are, you know, I'm talking in a general way.
Yeah, you're saying with these guys, you know, maybe and of course the other factor with what you're saying is there's also time frame. So if you started off with them, it seemed like you were saying they were leaner the first go around than the second go around.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, they were. Okay.
I'd definitely say so. You know, to an extent. Okay. Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah. So they got bigger and now let's say the first go around, they have 15 pounds of body fat to lose. And the next go around, they have 25 pounds of body fat to lose.
That sounds fair. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, I'm just throwing out numbers. But but you try to do that in 12 weeks each time?
No.
Or whatever. You try to do it in 12 weeks. It's going to be a hell of a lot different diet.
Yeah.
Those extra 10 pounds, because it's like a 60% faster fat rate or loss of fat or something like that. 15 versus 25 pounds. Like that's substantial.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to create a totally different caloric deficit, and you may have to like go to different extremes to make that happen. So yeah, this idea of like starting off with low carb, get the insulin sensitivity, and then consider adding carbs back in if you feel better with that would be, you know, when someone doesn't have to just like put the pedal to the metal to drop fat as fast as possible. So, anyway, yeah, that's an interesting insight with those guys. Are they coming back? Are they end up looking better at the end of that?
I just found they really have to struggle. Like they really, they really have to struggle after having really, really pushed to move up. Even if they gained more muscle, you'd think like, oh, well, they have more muscle. It'd be easier to diet them then, you know, but I've seen it happen more often than not, you know, that it's like, it's a real struggle then after like a real heavy, long bulk to get them in shape, to get them to respond to food. Like, you know, just as to be as responsive just in general, if that makes sense, if that's a word that makes sense, like responsiveness to changes.
Yeah. You have to induce a greater changes in the diet to get the fat to come off.
Exactly. Yeah. And, that's what I'm saying.
It sounds like maybe just more fat to lose. So you have to do that in order to get the fat loss.
Maybe it's just kind of one of the things, side story, something that just kind of came up.
Yeah. In my
head, thinking about the topic.
But back to this idea, like eventually, you know, they've got the one, the insulin receptor substrate gene, which was indicated in the A to Z reanalysis. The follow-up study by Gardner didn't show anything, but I don't think comparing 25 versus 50% of calories from carbs is that big of a difference. Like that's if you really want to expose any difference in the effect of insulin sensitivity on whether a low carb or a high carb diet works, you really want to have a really high carb diet and a really low carb diet, like a keto diet versus the highest one. I'm not sure why they didn't just repeat like the Ornish compared to Ornish and Atkins, because they already found that to be the case. I have to go and look. Maybe that's covered someplace that I missed in the study, but this gives us some guidelines. So eventually, you know, if they are able to replicate those data and find that insulin sensitivity is a predictor of which diet's going to work best for you, then you could come up with some genetic predictors. You know, we ran your genotype, Mrs. Smith, and it seems like you're going to do best with a ketogenic diet. Yeah. Or you'd be fine with a zone type diet. That'd be no problem for you. Or, you know, we'll put you on a Pritikin diet or what have you, any of the various options. So anyway, this is, I thought this was some pretty cool data to expose the fact that if people do go, like you, if you just look at the averages, and this is what happens all the time with the low and the high carb dietary discussions, is like they're the same. And that is true on average. But there's some variability in that. The plots from the Atkins all the way down to the Ornish with the range of like negative 30, like to that poor sucker who gained like 10 kilos on the zone diet, that's tremendous. That's what matters to the people. That's the applicability of science. That's for scientists, it's like it's just cool to be awash in a sea of statistics and nuances and ideas and intellectual flavor of the area that you study. It's like, oh, this is just cool. I like to tinker around. Some people like to go into their garage and like to tinker around with their car and futz around with this, that, and the other. But for other people, they just want to know what car is going to get me the best gas mileage and allow me to haul the things I need to haul or get the kids to school or, you know, what have you.
Sure.
And so digging in on the data in this way, in the way that Gardner did and followed up on, and the way that Damas et al. And Barcelos, those guys have done, is awesome. That to me is not only better science, but it's more applicable science, because they've actually gone and seen that, you know, we're not all the same. There is no average subject. Literally, there's no average person. You might have a number that matches the mean from some particular study in terms of some variable, but that would probably be the only one that matches. Everyone's different in terms of their responses and adaptations to a given stimulus. So what matters to you is what works for you. And the science can actually give us an idea, at least to know that, well, high frequency works better for some people and works better for other people. Lower frequency works better for other people. Some people just grow well, some people don't. Low carb works better for some people. Maybe if those who have the highest body fat or the least insulin sensitive are going to do best in that regard. Maybe not, but they're getting there. And so, you know, if you don't, I think it's a bastardization of the science sometimes to always to not look at the individual data. We don't do that very often. It's unfortunate. I heard on another podcast what's starting to happen more and more, which is really, really cool. And it's sort of funny because it's tradition has locked us into not doing this. But we have – you can put – how much data is on the internet? It's like the data explosion is just ridiculous. All – literally every single data set from every study that gets published now could be made public easily. You could just put it in the statistics file. We have PDFs for standardizing text files. You could do a standardized – like do an Excel spreadsheet or what have you, some standardized way to add data. And then people can go back and do reanalyses. And that's what these guys have done with their own data.
Okay.
And that's what people have been doing with others' data. They get a hold of data sets. They ask the authors, can I reanalyze your data?
Yeah.
Or they get it and you look at it, and every it's funny because you can have competent statisticians look at the same data set, and one will draw one conclusion which is substantiated, and another might draw another conclusion which is substantiated. And really it comes down to some degree to subjectivity and opinion. You know? And so someone could say, look at the Barcelos study. There was no difference. Frequency didn't matter. We studied all these people two, three, five times a week. Doesn't make a damn bit of difference. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter from when you ran the statistics that way. But I tell you what, it mattered for this guy. Look at this guy that gained 20% on the high frequency and only 7% on the low frequency.
Yeah.
It mattered for that dude. I know what I'd be doing if I were that guy. I'd be training with a higher frequency and or volume.
Sure.
And testing that out. So that would be my interpretation of this. So I think more we can do this, and more we can recognize that their chest means and the standard deviation bars are there for a reason, and the confidence intervals and all those sorts of things. That's super important if we're going to make any value from the science. So that's my rant for the week.
Well, thanks for sharing it with me, man. This is this is fun, and I think a lot of people are going to appreciate it. Guys, if you have not yet, you know, we were talking about Fortitude Training earlier, you can go to fortitudetraining.net, check out Dr. Scott's program, and of course, BYOBBcoach.com. I got the book right back there. Be Your Own Bodybuilding Coach. It's also available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble for the hardcover like I've got. And of course, guys, check out TrueNutrition.com. You can get a lot of great supplements like we talked about earlier today. Dr. Scott, as always, man, it's a pleasure.
Yes, it was fun.
All right, guys. We'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Adios.